Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The scores aren't official yet, but it looks like all the big banks did well enough on the government's stress tests. The president said today, things are getting better. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Cargill. Collaborate, create, succeed. This is how Cargill works with customers. Stories online at cargill.com/creates.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you here on this Friday. Today is the 10th of April. Everybody who's anybody in the Obama administration's economic team got some FaceTime with the boss today. The president met with his own advisors, with government banking regulators, and with the chairman of the Federal Reserve this morning. After his briefing, the president said there are, quoting here, glimmers of hope in the American economy. He reported progress in bank lending and easier credit for small businesses. He said stimulus spending is beginning to get down into infrastructure and energy projects. And he said he is keeping an eye on those banks. Our Washington bureau chief, John Dimsdale, has more.
The nation's banks begin reporting their earnings for the first quarter of 2009 next week, and the early indications are positive.
I think we're beginning to see signs of life and restoration in the economy. It's all beginning to work.
The banking industry's Scott Talbot says the government-run stress tests confirm the sector's financial strength.
The stress test is a hypothetical test showing the worst-case scenario. Even under those assumptions, the bulk of the banks are passing the tests.
But a Treasury spokesman wouldn't confirm any stress test findings. He says the government hasn't told the banks what the tests show and won't issue any results until the end of April. Goldman Sachs is signaling it will release positive earnings next Tuesday. The Wall Street Journal reports the bank is feeling strong enough to sell new shares to investors in order to pay back the $10 billion it borrowed from the government. But even with all the signs of stabilizing banks, President Obama said he remains cautious.
The economy is still under severe stress, and obviously during these holidays we have to keep in mind that whatever we do ultimately has to translate into economic growth and jobs and rising incomes for the American people.
Some analysts wonder whether banks are taking too much advantage of recent accounting changes that allow them to value their bad assets at higher prices than the market is willing to pay. They say there will be a lot of skeptical scrutiny of next week's earnings reports. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
The 70% of us whose computers use the Windows XP operating system are about to fall victim to what you might call planned obsolescence. XP is technically the old Windows system. Vista is their newest one. And as of next week, Vista users are going to be the ones Microsoft spends most of its time worrying about. Tamara Keith explains.
At Microsoft, when a piece of software reaches a certain age, it transitions from what the company calls mainstream support to what it calls extended support.
For the majority of customers, it's a relatively simple change.
Rich Kaplan is a corporate vice president at Microsoft. For home computer users, he says free support goes away Tuesday. The only automatic bug fixes customers will get are security patches.
We use something called Windows Update to do that. And essentially, that'll continue in the extended support phase.
And that will last until 2014. Now, this may seem like a not-so-subtle attempt to push people to a newer operating system, but Kaplan insists the switch has nothing to do with the release of new software.
We'd love people to upgrade to Windows Vista. When Windows 7 is available, we'd love to have them take a look at that. But it is important to note that Windows XP launched in 2001, so it's now 8 years in market, and that's a long time for software.
And at some point, a company like Microsoft can't let itself be bogged down with aging software, says John Abel, the New York bureau chief for Wired.com.
Sadly, time moves on, and nobody uses horses and buggies anymore. However, if you had one, you could easily have it maintained for a price.
And it's the same for Microsoft. For a fee, the company will help customers work through any issue they have with any version of its software. In Washington, I'm Tamara Keith for Marketplace.
This being Friday, you could be looking for something relaxing to do this evening. If you're hoping to find a new restaurant or a good spot for a happy hour, you might check out one of those online review sites, the ones that let users post their critiques of everything from restaurants to hardware stores. Yelp is one of those sites, a pretty popular one, in fact. About 20 million people a month use its reviews. But the site itself is getting some bad notices from small businesses. Marketplace's Jennifer Collins explains now what happens when everybody's a critic.
So I'm looking for a new pizza place in Los Angeles. I go on Yelp, and voila, Mama's Brick Oven Pizza. Sounds good. Except check out this review. Horrible, horrible, horrible customer service. They wouldn't take my coupon. There's only one problem.
We don't have any coupons.
That's Jamie Inzunza. She owns Mama's, and it's reviews like that, nasty and inaccurate ones, that really bug her because...
We couldn't reply to that because it has nothing to do with how our food tastes, you know?
She couldn't reply because Yelp wouldn't let her. Right now, companies can pay to come up first in a search on the site or pay to have their good reviews moved to the top of the list, but they can't talk back. Starting next week, though, Yelp will let businesses post responses to reviews. Carl Howe is a consumer researcher at Yankee Group.
They want to keep their business advertisers. They want to keep them happy. And if they can challenge the factual basis of bad reviews, I think that's a valid response.
But wait a second. If businesses are posting on the site, won't Yelp lose some credibility with users?
A lot of people will believe what the business says, and some may not. A lot depends upon what the reviews are and how entertaining they are in responding.
How's this for entertaining? One San Francisco restaurant printed its bad Yelp reviews on T-shirts and gave them out to its staff. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, nothing, nada, zip, bupkis. The financial markets were closed for Good Friday, but we will think of something to tell you when we do the numbers. Pretty much all the economists you talk to say the recession is going to end sooner or later. They just never say which one of those it is, sooner or later. That, of course, is the question of the day. To help us do our weekly wrap of Wall Street and beyond, we've got Katie Benner with us from Fortune Magazine and Mike Mandel. He's the chief economist at Business Week. Hello to you both.
Good to speak with you.
Glad to be here.
Mike, let me start with you and ask for a little compare and contrast. We had Lawrence Summers yesterday saying, you know, the free fall is going to be over soon. The president said this morning there is a glimmer of hope. And yet there have been some surveys out saying, you know what, nothing's really going to get better until like 2010. Whom are we to believe?
Well, these two things are completely consistent with each other. On the one hand, we may see the economy start to turn around in terms of GDP towards the second half of this year. They've pumped so much money into the economy that you got to feel like the bottom is somewhere close. But the labor market, which most people think of as the economy, may not recover till 2010 or maybe even later.
All right. Well, Katie, help me out here. Isn't everybody saying, or aren't a lot of people saying, listen, we need to get jobs back into this economy before anything can really turn around?
Certainly. I think that people feel that consumers won't start spending until they believe that they're going to have a job for more than 6 months out. And, you know, obviously consumer spending is a huge part of the economy. We will recover, but right now we're at a spot in the recovery that's very, very fragile, where we have banks that are earning money because interest rates are so low. It's hard for them not to make money when they can borrow at zero. But at the same time, they still have to deal with these legacy assets. It's a sort of a push and pull. Consumers are in the same place. We stopped spending so much. So in the first quarter, our earnings were better and we didn't spend as much money. So we didn't go as much into debt. And yet we might have debts that we still need to take care of. So we're also in a fragile place.
All right. But a word like fragility, Katie, doesn't really inspire confidence now, does it?
Okay, fragility is not a word that inspires confidence, but I think it's an accurate word.
Mike, what about you? Do you pick up on that sense of fragility?
Well, there is fragility, but it's interesting. If we think about consumer spending, for example, we all know that consumer spending is supposed to be 2/3 or 70% of the economy. But that number is actually deceiving because a big chunk of what the government counts as consumer spending is actually healthcare spending, which is coming mainly in large quantity from government money like Medicare and Medicaid. It also includes other things that are not outlays from the consumer wallet. And so, in fact, we could have an okay recovery before we have a recovery in the job market and before consumers actually start feeling confident. We don't need consumers to start spending before the economy starts to pick up.
Mike, let me ask you about, you know, the shape of this recovery. A lot of people have said, well, it could be a U recovery. It goes down real hard and then comes back up. There are some people talking about a V where it gets to a point and then bounces up nicely. And then I heard the other day some guys say, well, you know, it could be an L-shaped recovery, which doesn't really sound like recovery to me at all, right? It goes down and then it sort of flatlines. What do you think?
Or it could be a W, right, where it goes back up, goes back down, and comes back up again. Right at this point, I'm actually sort of split. I wouldn't be surprised to see a V towards the end of this year or early of next year because, in fact, they've put so much stimulus in, both monetary and fiscal. On the other hand, there are these drag factors. So right now, I think the real question is not about whether or not there's going to be recovery, but really how sharp and how strong it's going to be in terms of GDP.
Katie, what's your favorite letter?
I would say W, actually.
Really?
It's interesting. The government has had – I was talking to a couple of different economists and then investors like George Soros out there who also see a W, and their reasoning is that we've had to pump so much money into the economy, so much, just to keep it on life support and to keep it going and then to improve it, that eventually that money is going to be yanked out very, very quickly in order to prevent hyperinflation or even just inflation. And when that happens, it will put the brakes – on the economy again. And so we'll see a dip before we go back up. And I think that's an interesting argument for the W.
Katie Benner at Fortune Magazine, Mike Mendel, Chief Economist at Businessweek. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
The government of Japan announced another stimulus package today. If Parliament agrees, it will be the third time Tokyo has tried to prime its economic pump. Meanwhile, leaders of 16 Asian nations, including Japan, are meeting in Thailand today. They're trying to put the finishing touches on a plan to restore financial stability and economic growth in that region. There is some irony in their choice of venue. Southeast Asia was the epicenter of another financial crisis that shook world markets just over a decade ago. And as Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson reports, it all started in Bangkok.
Just like American homeowners thought the world was their oyster during the housing boom, a dozen years ago it was currency traders getting their kicks from exponential growth in Southeast Asia. The natives didn't mind, their currencies were worth so much they were spending like crazy. But then it all came crashing down, starting with the collapse of the Thai baht in the summer of 1997.
The tumbling Thai baht took other currencies with it in a domino-like drop.
Some people are calling it the Asian contagion. Currency and stock crises in Southeast Asia again shook markets all over the world.
The crash came after Thailand could no longer afford to keep its currency pegged to the dollar. Central bankers let it float, but it plunged instead, leaving it at the mercy of speculators. Jos Worso found himself at the center of the storm.
I was in the currency trading business myself in Europe at that time.
He's now head of global and wealth markets at Union Bank of California.
You had significant leveraged currency speculation, and as these currencies became more and more convertible and freely traded, you saw essentially each of these Asian countries, their currency being attacked one by one.
In other words, the investors who had given were now taking away. It was like a run on the bank, but instead of pulling their cash out of Jimmy Stewart's savings and loan, they were pulling out of countries.
And very soon, you saw one Asian economy after another collapse.
That's Raghu Rajan, a professor at the University of Chicago's Booth School of Business. He's a former chief economist for the International Monetary Fund. He says in this latest crisis, it was banks that collapsed one after the other. Banks so heavily leveraged and interlinked that all it took was a little push to put the whole system on the brink. Jos Worso says there's a lesson we should have learned long ago, and we haven't learned yet.
I think the key is to make sure that you don't find yourself in a bubble, and that could be as a country or as a company.
Okay, but that's sort of like telling a man who's having a heart attack to exercise more and eat less. Wasn't there a pill the Asian countries took or something we could take now?
Back then, at least we could isolate it, we could throw IMF in there, and address the issues essentially country by country, well, it's a very different situation we have today.
While the Asian financial crisis was going on, the rest of the world was okay. This time around, the rest of the world is going down with the United States, and that's unfortunately the problem associated with being the biggest economy in the world.
Rajan says the Asian countries were able to take advantage of their extremely cheap currencies post-crisis. Rich countries like the U.S. bought Asian goods at incredible discounts and reinvigorated their economies. But there's no one big enough to buy the U.S. out of the trouble it's in.
The U.S. is not getting the lifeline from the rest of the world. It's not being pulled out, in part because the rest of the world is in the same pit with it.
And worse still, he says, we have no idea whether or not we're at the bottom of the pit yet. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
Coming up, Southern California real estate finally gets the memo. It is a buyer's market.
It's the first time anything has started to drop in this area. So it's not going to be condos and townhomes for over $1 million because nobody's going to be able to do that these days. It's just not happening.
But first, let's do the numbers. With the country's financial markets closed for Good Friday, much of the focus today was on one number in particular, the more than $192 billion in debt that Uncle Sam managed to run up during the month of March. We are barely halfway through the fiscal year, and already the Treasury Department's red ink gauge is at historic levels. The annual deficit so far is approaching $1 trillion. So we have already more than doubled last year's $455 billion annual record. It's not just that Uncle Sam is spending more either. He's also taking in less, in some cases a lot less. Corporate tax revenues are off by more than half compared to what they were in the first half of fiscal 08. Overall, federal tax revenues have fallen by more than 13% from the previous budget year. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals, institutions, and advisors reach their long-term financial goals. 1-888-VANGUARD. Let us do the work for you. Download Marketplace's After the Bell, a podcast which makes sense of a week's worth of business news. Just go to marketplace.org and click on the podcast link.
Marketplace State Book, here's a look at events coming up Monday. Those decorated hard-boiled eggs are put to work. The annual Easter egg roll takes place at the White House. If you don't get in on the presidential egg roll, have no fear. There is another post-Easter tradition, Egg Salad Week. And it's the anniversary of the birth date of our third president. Thomas Jefferson was born on April 13, 1743. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. The piracy drama that's playing out off the coast of Somalia gets more complicated by the day. This morning, we learned the captain of the container ship that was hijacked earlier this week tried to escape, only to be recaptured. And there is word a second hijacked ship, still under the control of the pirates, is making its way toward the lifeboat that the captain of the first ship is being held in. So far, there are no confirmed reports of a ransom demand, but piracy is big business in Somalia. Last year, Somali pirates collected around $80 million in ransom money from shipping companies or their insurers. And Ashley Milne-Tite reports they may not be the only ones paying up.
Trawling the high seas these days means paying a high price in insurance. Former counterterrorism agent Richard Schoberl says insurance companies have raised their premiums for a single journey through dangerous waters.
Some of them now are charging up to $30,000 to $40,000 U.S. dollars per $3 million worth of coverage. And some people are opting only to pay certain parts of that premium. Some shipping companies are because it's hard for them to afford it.
Some shippers opt to insure vessel and crew and ignore the costs of the cargo itself. And he says many hire security companies to train their crews to combat pirate attacks. Some ships even carry security teams on board. Bonnie Ghosh chairs the International Maritime Business Department at the Massachusetts Maritime Academy. She says everything costs more when there's a risk of piracy.
Crew are demanding double pay. It's a compensating difference that companies are providing because of the additional security threats these crew members are having to go through.
She says the whole point of moving most goods by sea rather than by air is that it's cheaper. But she says that cost advantage will evaporate if pirates keep threatening the world's shipping channels.
And although we feel this is a problem that's happening hundreds of miles away, eventually that cost burden is going to fall on the person who buys the product at the end of the day. It's going to fall on you and me.
She says unless the rate of pirate attacks drops, we can expect to pay more for goods that come to the US from overseas. Everything from shoes and clothing to computers. I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
Part of the government's economic turnaround plan looks like it's taking hold. As we've mentioned, the Federal Reserve has been buying up long-term Treasury bonds as a way to drive interest rates down. And judging by what Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac have to say, it's paying off. The mortgage giants reported this week refinancings doubled last month as homeowners look to cut their payments. The calendar this time of year traditionally gives the housing industry another boost. Typically, this is the busiest home buying season of the year. But typical doesn't really mean much right now. Alex Cohen hits some open houses for us here in Southern California.
This three-story townhouse in the neighborhood of Santa Monica is so close to the Pacific Ocean, you can hear the seagulls. Officially, it's a two-bedroom, but, says realtor Melissa Improta, with the upstairs loft, it's almost like having a third room.
Definitely enough room up here to be a playroom, to be an office. You've got sliding glass doors that lead out to your own private roof deck. And then you've got a French door over here.
Not long ago, hardly anyone showed up to open houses like this one. Back then, this property also might have cost $1 million. Today, it's listing at $849,000. And potential buyers started showing up a half hour before the open house began. Among them, Brenda Rentschler.
The interest rates are going down, and I just kind of want to start the process of looking for a home.
Brenda's friend, Alexandra Nicole, is also looking to take advantage of mortgage rates that have dropped below 5%. She's wanted to buy in this neighborhood for a long time, but didn't even consider looking until now.
It's the first time anything has started to drop in this area, so it's not going to be condos and townhomes for over $1 million because nobody's going to be able to do that these days. It's just not happening.
It's just not happening in a lot of places anymore. Realtor Melissa Improta.
Sellers, I think, have finally realized that it's a buyer's market and that there's not a whole lot they can do about it.
We know that this is not the time to be looking for that big, I'm going to cash in on my house and get that equity going. You know, it's just a tough market.
Minerva Cornelio and her husband Jonathan recently sold their home in Burbank, California for $449,000. That's $16,000 less than they bought it for in 2004. The Cornelios have accepted that loss. They do need more room for their two young kids, and soon they'll be moving into her parents' former home, which has more space. Still, Minerva can't help but remember when they almost sold their 1,100-square-foot house a couple of years ago. That's when houses in her neighborhood were going for $600,000.
And I wish. I'm kicking myself for that right now. You know, we should have done that 2 years ago, and we could be shopping for a bigger home right now.
It's easy to get distraught in today's market, no matter which side of the deal you're on, says Lois Vitt. Vitt wrote a book about the psychology of home buying and selling.
It's scary. We have people with decision paralysis who are afraid to go out on the limb.
That's why the federal government is giving a bit of a push. As part of the stimulus package, anyone who hasn't owned a home in 3 years can get an $8,000 tax credit to buy a house.
We had a string of really good positive news over the past 6 weeks.
And that's encouraging after months of dismal reports, says Patrick Newport, an economist with IHS Global Insight.
Housing permits and housing starts were up. Existing home sales were up. New home sales were up. And all of these increases were far greater than the consensus projection.
Newport says a few more rounds like that, perhaps buyers and sellers will finally believe they've seen the bottom. In Los Angeles, I'm Alex Cohen for Marketplace. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering absolute return funds with goals designed to match yours. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
We spend most of our time on this broadcast finding the big stories for you, trying to make sense of what's going on out there. That is, except for about a minute and a half every other Friday. That's when Rico Galliano and Brendan Noonan quiz the Marketplace staff to try to find some of the stories that went under the radar, the stuff you might want to talk about at a dinner party this weekend.
Jeremy Hobson, New York reporter. What story are you going to be talking about this weekend?
Well, it turns out, Rico, that even reality TV is starting to reflect economic reality.
Oh, my word. How so?
Well, the show Paris Hilton's My New BFF, which I know you're a big fan of, it turns out the mansion that the contestants live in this new season will cost half as much as the mansion they lived in last season to save money.
And America weeps.
Yes, and there's no word yet on whether the contestants will be judged on their ability to renegotiate the terms of the mansion's adjustable rate mortgage.
Betsy Streisand, senior editor at Marketplace. What's your story?
The story I like this week is a story about Reebok getting into the flying trapeze business.
What could possibly go wrong with this plan?
Oh, they've teamed up with Cirque du Soleil to create an exercise program where people fly from trapezes, which if you've ever seen Cirque du Soleil, you know that that's not happening at any gym in America. You know, these people have an extra chromosome for bendy.
Stacey Vanek-Smith, senior reporter for Marketplace, go.
Well, the banks are in even more trouble right now.
Did they start robbing banks?
No, there's been this wave of lawsuits from companies like Texas Instruments and other places that invested in auction rate securities that the banks said were safe but turned out to be worthless.
So basically, our bailout money could go to the banks and then they could be sued by investors who would get it back.
Right, except a lot of it will probably go to the lawyers.
So this is, in a way, this is stimulus for America's last remaining industry.
It's true. Lawsuits are too big to fail.
That is just a taste of Rico and Brendan's podcast. It is called The Dinner Party Download, and we've got a link to the full meal on our website. It's marketplace.org. That is Marketplace from American Public Media this Friday afternoon. The markets were closed today because today is Good Friday. They'll be open up again on Monday. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer of the program is J.J. York. Coming up on Monday, last October, we went cross-country on this broadcast to hear how folks felt about the economy.
Things are still good here, and I think that the banking system is going to come back. As much of anything, it's a credibility problem right now, and that the credibility problem causes people to have less confidence in Wall Street.
We are going to hit the road to ruin again next week, looking perhaps for signs of a recovery. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have yourself a great weekend, everybody.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.